But that's the thing, is that it is impermanent, like everything else. Eternal hell is impermanent. It feels that way. And this is the notice that, like, rationally you can understand, but on the emotional level we feel a different way. Like, if we feel that, even though you say, "I know this is just temporary," like if you're depressed, your rational mind will say, "I know it's impermanent and all that." But it feels permanent. It feels like this. And this is so that you also have to accept the feeling of that. Not believe it, but realize it's only a feeling. It's not the truth. And then happiness, and I contemplate. Like, I used to contemplate heaven, if I was going to heaven, and things that make me happy. And you know, just like saying, getting gifts, people giving you nice things, makes you happy. So then you contemplate spending eternity just receiving nice gifts. And you can see that it would get boring. You know, you can and then so I mean, the different kind of happiness of, say, that you can imagine, of, or say, like having delicious food, or say sensual happiness. You realize that sensual happiness is you know, is enjoyable because that it is a peak moment. It's not something you're going to have on a continuous basis. Is a kind of delicious food every moment of your life, because we, you know, sometimes you have with too much delicious food, you long for just like boiled cabbages sometimes. Sometimes the food here, we get such delicious food, spicy and that you get tired of gourmet delicious tidbits and marvelous lasagnas and all that. You just like to have a Brussels sprout boiled without anything on it. Things like this. So it's, those things are always relative to other things. Then joy, say in this life, joy is like giving to others. So that's that kind of happiness, joyfulness is done not through trying to get for yourself, but through your ability to give and help other people. And so that is a beautiful experience. And that is very helpful towards spiritual development. We're just seeking happiness through getting what you want doesn't develop you spiritually at all. You know, it maybe give you that kind of happiness, but it's a very temporary experience. Where, say, joy is definitely a factor of enlightenment, so that as we develop joy in our lives, then that comes through selfless giving. Then a lot of people who think they'll go to hell, because people tend to say, hold on to their faults and exaggerate their faults. So, and or the bad things you've done in your life, you give great importance to where they're exaggerated beyond, say, the good things of your life. So I know, like people here in Britain, it's very easy for people to exaggerate what's wrong with themselves or somebody or with anything. It becomes a dominant kind of obsession of the mind, and even when it's only a little thing in perspective, yet when by the obsession with it, it becomes, that's all you see, that's all you think about. So that's why reflecting is also, reflecting on the goodness of your life is very important to remember the goodness of your life, to bring that into consciousness, not as patting yourself on the back. It's not conceit. It's a kind of gratitude and a remembrance of the good things of one's life and the good things that one has done, or the good things that others have done for you. And this is very, because this will give you perspective on the fact that, say, on the mistakes and the flaws, that, you know, that's not the only thing, and that's not the, you know, and sometimes those are relatively minor in comparison to most of one's life. But yet, you know, the obsession, the way the mind can obsess itself, it can take some niggling little thing and build it up into a universal obsession. Don't know. He's probably staying there till he needs to, till he realizes he can get out. Right, that's a very good question. Because one does see that in that our age now is one where we're endlessly demanding rights, and we don't have a sense of duties, what we owe to our parents or to our society. And so we become very self-centered, you know, I have the right for this and I have my rights. And of course it does give you, it doesn't bring joy into the society. Rights are, it's not that it's, rights are wrong, but it's the obsession of my rights that becomes the where you aren't going to get any joy, even if you get all your rights. You're still life's still going to be joyless, because the joy comes from performing your duties or doing things for others selflessly is what joy comes from. And therefore, it's joy is something that we can experience no matter what position we're in, even if we don't have any rights. Or like slavery is not an obstruction to enlightenment or joy. Even though one is not kind of, would hate to see slavery come back. But, you know, in terms of actual experience of life, the people do suffer a lot with when they have all their rights, because the mind is still conditioned to see that, you know, expecting a lot from life. And I think when we don't expect so much from life and we think of you know, how do we, like being a Buddhist monk, for example, we don't have many rights. We don't have the freedom that the lay people have. We can't carry money. We can't, play games, and we have a celibate, and we lose all our rights. So why would we choose a life that takes away your rights? You know, it would be a tyranny if we were forced to become monks or nuns and pushed into it, and then it would be a tyranny. But because we choose this, because therefore it, we give up our rights, you know, because we think that's a good idea. And then we learn how to perform our duties within the Sangha structures. And that helps you to develop mindfulness around your own kind of... like I found a lot of problems around authority when I first became a monk. Because being American, you're very much... you're conditioned, culturally conditioned, to think in terms of rights and equality. And so hierarchical structures and authority are always very threatening. You don't know how to cope with it. You've never been trained, or you don't know how to relate to hierarchical structures. So you just tend to say they're all wrong and talk about freedom. But in the Sangha life, then you have this, it's, you know, you learn how, when you're a new monk, you have certain duties to perform to the senior monks. The senior monks have duties that they have for the taking care of the junior ones and so forth. And so but you're learning how, but it brings up, with me anyway, a lot of the fear of authority and a lot of it was just I didn't know how to, because I hadn't lived in a structure where I'd been trained to deal with hierarchy. I tended to feel threatened by those above me, by those who had power over me. Tended to see them in negative ways, resisting them. And then through seeing that, then I could let go of that and begin to operate more harmoniously within the system itself. You're not making the problem about the system. You're trying to develop a way of living with each other where you support each other for spiritual growth. And where if it is merely into having a worldly position, have power over somebody else, then it's tyranny. But if your hierarchical structures are there to just coordinate our endeavors towards spiritual awakening, then one finds it, it's a helpful thing rather than a hindrance. And another thing is in regards to rights, sometimes people don't realize they have moral rights. And so... like they had for the past 2 years, they had meetings in Dharamsala with the Dalai Lama, the American, most of them American Vipassana and Zen teachers, and these in America, they've had a lot of problems with say teachers taking advantage of their students. And a lot like sexual things where the teacher would take sexual advantage of their students and things like this. And this has been a continuous kind of problem in the Buddhist world in the West, because Western Buddhism very much comes from the idea of Buddhism is just about mindfulness. It has nothing to do with morality. And so you get this in America especially, where Zen or Vipassana are taken out of the context of a tradition, and they're really promoted as, you know, these kind of enigmatic stories of the Japanese Roshi that spits on the Buddha Rupa, or these kind of outrageous things that Americans love to hear about. You know, to prove you're enlightened, you go drink a bottle of sake and things like that. Americans love that. Because it gives them that sense of you don't have to bind yourself to any kind of moral principles. That all you have to do is be mindful and outrageous and rebellious, like the rebel without a cause, or to the one that thumbs his nose at all the rules, the good monk that keeps all the rules and is uptight and tense and nervous, and the real swinger that kind of broke all the rules and is liberated through his rebellious freedom. And it's kind of romantic images of the rebel and the one who goes against the establishment and frees himself or herself through all kinds of outrageous conduct. Is a kind of romantic image that people find very attractive. Hermann Hesse promoted this in his novels, and those became very popular in the 60s. We were reading Hermann Hesse novels. But the thing is that in a country like the States, America, is it doesn't have any tradition to rebel against. So you do get this kind of this rebel without a cause problem. It's just like teenage rebels. There's nothing to rebel against. You're just rebelling. Say in Japan, I imagine if you've ever been to Japan or know how that society works, it's rigid with rules and duties and even in the loosest society there, they still got. You know, they've still got the most rigid social structures and demands and duties to perform, not to mention the monasteries. So it may be in a context of Japanese culture, there has to be a bit of this outrageous behavior to break out of these highly socially conditioned patterns of deference and obedience. But say for most of us, we don't come from such societies. We thumb our nose at our parents and swear at the teacher and go our own way without ever having any opportunity to develop a sense of duty and conformity to a system. So that's why the kind of Zen approach, as it's been. That's not really Zen, but how it's been translated into Western terms as this kind of libertine attitude. But the thing that, getting back to the moral right, is that if you're really interested in having rights, then it seems to me the rights that are really important are that we have a right to have moral integrity. And this we should demand our right. We shouldn't. People have no right to take away our moral integrity or to compromise it. So this is why it's. But yet, most of the people in America aren't demanding moral rights. They're demanding all kinds of rights, but moral ones. But this is just a reflection if students know their rights, then they wouldn't be seduced by the teachers. And if the teachers is important to inform them of their rights, you see, and the teachers. Rights are also moral rights, meaning that my power is not to be used for selfish ends. Because if you're in a teaching position, you have people give you power over them. So that you have influence. You have people look at you. They listen, or they project onto you all kinds of things. So if one misuses that power, then that is very damaging thing. So that's why you want to establish the relationship, say in a spiritual way that is right and responsible for both parties. And this is very important. And so sometimes it's very disturbing for us when you hear people still talking, teaching meditation with no sense of moral responsibility. You know, they still don't see that they need to take any kind of moral responsibility for themselves. And yet they want to be meditation teachers and be in a position of teaching Dhamma to other people without that kind of commitment. And it's very disturbing to see. And because they say the moral side of life tends to be seen only in Europe, for example, the morality is equated with oppression, like rules imposed on you that you have to obey or you'll be punished or ostracized. So like the Victorian morality of where it's a kind of hypocrisy, where you're forced to act a certain way out of fear of being socially ostracized. But now that's not true. People can do pretty much anything they want and they're not ostracized for it, unless it's too far out. But we also change our attitude towards that morality is something we take, we develop, not something imposed on us. And it's our right to live a moral life. It's our privilege, our honor, that we can choose, that we have the ability to take responsibility for how we live, for how I live, how I'm going to live my life, how I'm going to use this body and my abilities, whether I'm going to use them for helping or harming or whatever. It's up to me. I can choose one or the other. And in a spiritual development, you have tremendous responsibility because people do give you power over them, and you can influence. So that's why you have to be really careful about how you use that, so that your intention is always for the welfare of the people, rather than, say, for any kind of personal or selfish interest. So that's why I think when a monk or a guru or something falls, it's really a heavy crash. because a misuse of power is on the spiritual plane is a very heavy thing. If one's going to take on that role of being a spiritual guide or teacher, you better be careful, because if it's done for the wrong reasons, it has a very bad result. Also, like seeing just the change of perspective, where one, say, you see, like, the common view of your own life is that your mind is in your body. So that you know, when you say, where is your mind, you either point here, your brain, or to your heart. You think of it as inside here. You know, that's how we generally relate. The mind is in here, and the body's here. And the mind is inside the body. But as you meditate more and more, then develop the mindfulness, then you realize that the body is in the mind. Different. So that changes your relationship. Instead of seeing the mind as something inside you, you're able to. Do you see that the body and the senses and this psychophysical organism is more like a receptor or a radio or radar network or something. It's not a person, but it is capable of picking up the messages. And so one begins to see it in terms of it really not being oneself. It's more like an instrument, sensitive instrument, that we now find ourselves experiencing life through it. But it's not me anymore. It's not the mind is inside the brain or inside the body, and therefore the idea of going to hell or heaven for eternity, or you know, you realize that those are just ways of thinking and talking that come from a worldly way of thinking, but it's not the way things are. So you begin to feel this sense like of oneness and connectedness, because on the level of consciousness we're, you know, in the purity of consciousness we're one. It's not like we're my consciousness and your consciousness is this person. The personality comes and goes through the conditioning of the mind. So when we're just with the silence of the mind, the emptiness of the mind, there's no person. There's not me as opposed to you, separate from you. But when the person arrives, then I'm thinking when the person arrives, I am Ajahn Sumedho and you are this person, and then I arise and you arise in the mind. And so you realize that that's why on the intuitive plane or psychic plane communications can take place, or messages come through that sensitivity rather than through just the kind of verbal functions and verbal habits that we have. So in terms of affecting each other, we realize everything's affecting everything. What's happening in the world isn't just Rwanda or some place in Africa that doesn't you know, is none of my business. But we recognize that we feel more attuned to the whole universal system as one thing, and that we aren't just separate. You know, I can just live my life and protect myself and what I have, forget about the rest of it. Because as you open the mind more, you feel this sense of oneness with it all. You feel related to everything, everyone. Well, that's, then you have to take into account the fact that you have to get through the, You have to finish. You have to take the exam. Well, at least you're learning. Maybe you don't have to do it. Well, I think when I think back of when I was in the university, it was after you took the exam that was all over you, and this tremendous sense of relief. One of the happiest moments of my life was when I left the military. I remember that, walking out. I was discharged from this naval base in San Francisco called Treasure Island. And I remember walking out the gate with my discharge papers and looking back and thinking, I'll never have to go through this. It got a really euphoric moment I've always remembered. Like getting out of prison. But sometimes, you know, in worldly things, it's not to... despise the world or to refuse to participate in it, but it's to put it in a context that we can we can relate to the world in a way that isn't just reinforcing bad habits and just overwhelming us. So meditation is to help us get perspective rather than to just reject the world. Because if we just know the world, then we become obsessed by it, and we get taken over by all the worldly things. But once we realize that the world isn't our main object anymore, and we're not empowering it with all our belief and attention, then we can work in the world in a more effective way. Do what needs to be done or what is right to do in a more effective way than we do when we're still believing in the world through the old self view. So it's the knowing, like the, one of the qualities of the Buddha is knower of the worlds, the loka vidu. Loka is the world, and the vidu is a seer or a knower. And so, the Buddha knows the world. He knows the taste, the flavor, what the world is. And so, the world can't delude him. And the world has many flavors, all pleasant, unpleasant, so forth. But we also recognize that all worldly things, if grasped, take us to suffering. So then the insight is to know the world but not grasp it. So then we live in a society, we live in a conventional world. Of a traditional society and so forth that we can still operate in, but we know it. We're not of the world anymore, but we can still function in it. Well, that I see in terms of more a mental process, you know, because the Buddha was pointing to what we can know directly, and there's too much speculation about, you know, like reincarnation and things like this. Not that they're, I don't believe it, but it's not something that is very important for me to think about, because I'm more aware of the process of the mind and how desire works. So like in Buddhist teaching, especially like with the paticca-samuppada or the dependent origination, you begin to observe the process of attachment, of, say, desire, attachment, becoming, and rebirth through the mind, you see. And as you understand that, then you can figure out how that might work on a wider scale, because it's the same pattern. I mean, like desire is always this, it's that kind of always looking for something. When we're caught up in the powers of desire, then we're always, even when we, you know, maybe we don't really need anything or really don't want anything, but the power of desire is still looking for something to distract or to be reborn into. So that's why in contemplating desire, getting to know what desire is, we can free ourselves from becoming the desires. We can, by seeing that. So then, I assume when it's time to die, that you just aren't grasping after desires to live. And but the body is, or become somebody, or hang on to things of the world, because you've already released your grasp on the worldly conditions, and then the desire to live is based on the illusion of conditionality rather than on the understanding of Dhamma, and the refuge in Dhamma is refuge in the deathless, not in the death-bound. So Nibbana is the realization of the deathless. And so the deathless is where the thinking mind stops. You can't think of the deathless. You can't imagine it. But it because thinking, thought, imagery are conditions of the mind. And so you're letting go of the conditions of the mind. More and more you're realizing the emptiness or the unconditioning of the mind itself, where the problem resolves itself. But in terms of, like, common teaching, like, when you're, say, in a society where people are... aren't meditating or aren't reflecting, then you use more the reward, the carrot and stick approach. If you're good, you get rewarded by going to heaven. If you're bad, you get punished. And that's the Sunday school approach, because that's how life is when you're a child, isn't it? You're if you're good, your mother says you're a good boy. If you're bad, she spanks you. Things like this. So that's. That's the, or they don't spank anymore. If you're a bad mother, your little boy sues you in the court. Customs do change. let's say for... In the world, then the reward and punishment practice is very much generally how people still think. And so I remember in Thailand they'd have these pictures of in some of the meeting houses and that, where, you know, hell, people that told lies, their tongues were being pulled out with red hot tongs in some hell realm, and or people that committed adultery were kind of climbing up. They were stark naked, trying to climb up thorny trees with rabid dogs chasing them, and the most gruesome kind of pictures of torture and humiliation and pain of hell for, say, stealing or killing. And these are, you know, this is, our teacher in Thailand used to say, this is just for the, you know, this is what they call, for children. Because people say only understand if you're bad, you're going to be punished. If you're good, you go to heaven and be rewarded. And some people don't want to go beyond that way of thinking. But in the Buddhist teaching, the Buddha was recognized that that's one level of, you know, suitable for a certain level or age. But when you're developing a spiritual path, then that's not the way it is. You realize the hell is what you create in your mind. Like if I tell a lie, even if I'm never found, I'm not discovered, no one ever knows it, I know it. And that knowing of my own is a kind of hell experience, which says, well, I'm going to be careful so I don't, you know, I've got to take responsibility for my speech. So then I'm learning about how things actually are, that if I do bad things, then even if I'm not caught or punished by the society, that I punish myself. So then it's hard to live with yourself. You can't live with yourself if you've been deceitful, or at least I can't. You know, in this life, you have to have this integrity. And if you're being dishonest and deceitful in it, then I can't imagine. I think being a monk would be a hell realm, because the only way it really works is by developing that kind of integrity with it. Because if one is just using the system for personal advantage, I'd be frightened of that. If I'm going to be a criminal, I'd disrobe and do it some other way. Too frightening to think of it, because in the one, I do have a lot of respect for it, and also you recognize that you know, when you are through meditation, you're becoming more and more sensitive, and that sensitivity, if you're not developing integrity and being responsible for yourself, then that sensitivity would be very painful. So, you know, in some ways, you hear people think, I wish I'd never started meditating. Because sometimes you think it'd be nice to go back and be the old, ignorant, insensitive guy I used to be. No, because the sensitivity can be... you're very sensitive to things, and one part of you wishes you didn't feel anything. But then as you break through from that kind of reaction, then you really appreciate the sensitivity, because you're not taking it personally anymore. You're letting go of the personal interpretations of this sensitive state. And you're seeing it as a great gift rather than as a personal kind of problem. Well, it's not. The Buddha wouldn't. You know, you talk. I think in Mahayana they use words like Dhammakaya and that. But it's in Theravada you just use the word Dhamma. And but it the Buddha didn't want to make a kind of like a one mind type of teaching. And the kind of he was avoiding that kind of language, because he's aiming at a realization rather than than adopting a position. So it's quite subtly phrased in the way the Buddha taught to avoid making kind of metaphysical positions, and because of that, sometimes it's. I think Buddhism is greatly misunderstood because people tend to think that we don't have any metaphysics at all, that we're just a kind of atheistic approach, but it's not as simple as that. Because it is intuitive and it's. And it's reflective. You're not trying to fill the mind with positions that you come from, but from the emptiness of the mind. You're trying to aim to empty the mind of any positioning or any attachments to realize that. So the avoidance of holding on even to ultimate doctrines. Like you can see it in. The dangers of like Christianity have now with God as being always personified as a father or in the Trinitarian form because then you get all these male figures. God is a man. Inevitably we say God, he said this or he wants that. Well, and then God is in Catholic theology now, there's a movement towards seeing God as no thing, which is very interesting. Because in terms of a meditative experience, that's how you'd see it. But if you're always convinced that God is some kind of father figure, then that'd be a kind of obstruction, I should think. You get so far and you couldn't get beyond it, because you're looking. Your expectations would be around that particular image. Whereas, say, with the Buddhists, you're letting go of all the imagery, all the expectations and assumptions of even the religion itself, to that emptiness. And then that realization is the and with the Christian mystics they talk like that too. The actual mystical experience is the letting go rather than the finding God. It's the letting go of things. Well, it's like that also, in Thai you have like the original mind, they say Chit-dham or Buddha nature, or these are ways of talking about that which you don't, because the Buddha in his actual terminologies, in the Pali canon anyway, was very careful not to use those kind of words, because I think that's because of the tendency to see the like the Hindu concept of Atman. Atman is a kind of oversoul or a god, or to come from a kind of oneness position, a monistic formula. Because practically speaking, how this works is through relinquishment rather than through an attachment to a position, even of oneness. So we even let go of the idea of oneness, which doesn't mean we don't believe in oneness, but we're letting go of even the attachment to the ideal of oneness, so that the mind is free from any position, any form, the emptiness, the non-attachment, to realize non-attachment is nibbana. And then that realization is, you know, you have to realize it to know it. You can't say anything about it. But then the Buddha did say it was the highest happiness. But then we think, that sounds like an extreme. And I mean, this is the problem with language. Language is very dualistic, you see. So you want to emphasize in a kind of hyperbole, you say the highest happiness. It doesn't mean highest happiness in a worldly sense. Right, well, I mean, you have the kind of Pure Land teachings, and they tend to be more like devotional approaches. So, I mean, it's not like you've got to have it just this. I mean, there is a tendency sometimes to want to think this is the pure teaching, and all the rest is heretical. But I don't like to think like that, in terms of rigid structures, because actually you can look at things from many different angles, from different ways. And like Pure Land Buddhism definitely has a kind of gladdening ability, and it certainly attracts masses of people. The Four Noble Truths is a teaching for only those with a little dust in their eyes. It's not going to be popular teaching. You don't popularize Buddhism by teaching the Four Noble Truths. You popularize it by, like they do the Japanese ones that promise you if you say a mantra you'll get a Rolls Royce or win £1 million, or you'd get everything you want, or you'd be happy forever. I mean, those kind of things are what would be popular forms. And so you have Amitabha and things like we don't have in Theravada. You don't have Amitabha Buddha and these different forms of Buddha that you have in Mahayana, because Mahayana kind of expanded and met on people's needs in different levels. And also was influenced probably by the existing religious forms that, like in China, was already a highly developed civilization by the time Buddhism came. You know, it was still already fully developed as a civilization. So Buddhism was adapted to the Chinese civilization. Whereas, say, in Sri Lanka or Thailand, Burma, countries like that, they're probably more influenced. I mean, their civilization grew from Buddhism. Like Thai civilization really is very Buddhist. And its culture and its refinements came out through its contact with Buddhism. So that you didn't have a conflict there, say, with a that you do have in, like, in animistic beliefs or Brahmanistic beliefs, but they tend, in Thailand, they tend to be seen only in terms like that, and the Buddha's teaching is considered the, you know, is the dominant religion. But in China, for example, the Pure Land and the Chan school, oftentimes they teach them in together in the same monastery. So I know the city of 10,000 Buddhas in California, there's a Chinese monastery, and they teach Pure Land Buddhism, and they teach the Zen or Chan Buddhism, and the Chan form is more monastic, and people that are inclined into that type of meditation. But masses of people tend to prefer the Pure Land, where you say your mala beads and do your bowing prostrations and chant mantras, and makes you feel happy, and then you go home, you feel much better. So it has, and, you know, and that's a good thing to do. You know, people would spend more time chanting and saying mala beads and bowing, there'd be less crime, people would be a lot happier. they'd be using their time more skillfully than just sitting around watching television. Better for you than playing golf. People don't believe me, but that's I don't know. You got me there. Next 20 years.
Within the next 20 years.
Well, have you heard any report? Do you have any information I might not have?
No, it was just
certainly be nice, wouldn't it? That's the reality of it. We have that potential, you know, of like now, say we're under the teaching of Gotama the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, and that teaching, say, so we're like what we call sawakas, people who, we don't have to discover a teaching, we've already got the teaching. So we don't have to, you know, find some other teaching or discover our own, but really using the one that we have for enlightenment, for seeing things in the right way. The thing, and you feel like now in the throughout the world, you see there is, like the state, in one way you can see it all in pretty dire terms of you know, pollution and overcrowded population and population problems and all that. But also you realize that there are more and more, like say here in Britain, for example, an awakening that's taking place in people's lives. And you see it everywhere, you know. In not just here, but this is where I happen to live, so I'm more aware of what's happening here. But and say 20 years or 30 years ago, that wasn't the case. There were very few people knew anything about meditation or interested in religion at all. So in the, you know, there has been a shift and an openness to religion in all its aspects, and also to the reflective capacities of the mind, not just, you know, prayers and ceremonial forms, but also to the contemplative style. So, and I trust in that. I trust that even though on one level,